How to find more joy in life by noticing what's there around you already rather than wishing it could all change. The book is Look Again, The Power of Noticing What Was Always There. The scientific term is dishabituating. Dr. Tali Sharrett is a neuroscientist and a professor of cognitive neuroscience at both University College London and MIT. Her two TED Talks have been viewed 15 million times. She's written this new book with Cass Sunstein, the Harvard Law School professor, who's the best-selling author of the book Nudge. Tali's previous books include The Science of Optimism and The Influential Mind, What the Brain Reveals About Our Power to Change, and it was selected as a best book of 2017 by Forbes and the London Times, Bloomberg and the Stanford Business School. Professor Tali Sharrett, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Habituation, that's the word we'll use a bit. It's habituation is when we ease our way into a chilly swimming pool or the ocean. I've seen this example. And soon enough, it stops feeling cold and we get on with exercising or having fun in the water. That's a reasonable analogy for a main aspect of habituation.
Yeah, so habituation is our tendency to respond less and less to things that are constant or frequent, that change very gradually. And as you mentioned, temperature is one. So another example that's kind of easy to comprehend is you walk into a room, it's full of smoke. When you first walk in, the smoke can be quite overwhelming and salient. But studies show that within 20 minutes, people actually cannot even detect the smell any longer. So whatever it is, whether it's something you smell or some temperature that you feel, but also, you know, it's just things that we have in life. If they've been there around us for a long time, they might not elicit the same feeling that they did initially. So maybe a relationship at first, you know, has more of an excitement element to it than after a relationship that you've been in for a long time.
And there are good and bad examples, like getting used to pollution as we commute to work, like getting used to cigarettes in a room. That explains why so many people in the old days got away with having ashtrays on their desks in offices, Tali, actually, doesn't it?
Yeah, because they stop smelling it, right? So you come into their office, you can smell it. It's very salient, but they can't even smell it. Their olfactory neurons don't react to the smell because it's around them all the time. But it's not even bad smells. It's also if you just buy a new perfume, when you first put the perfume on you, you can really detect its scent. The second day, a little bit less. For a day, a little bit less. And, you know, a month goes by and you can't detect the smell of your own perfume, but other people can, right? They sit next to you on the subway. They can definitely detect the smell. There's a lot of things that we have in our life that are quite good. Perhaps someone has a loving relationship or a comfortable home or an interesting job. But because those things have been there for a long time, they don't really elicit that same joy, the same happiness that they would otherwise. But if you take a break from life, if you just go away for, you know, just a few days, maybe on a business trip, maybe you leave for a week and then you come back, what tends to happen is that suddenly you can kind of see and feel those things again. Suddenly you appreciate your comfortable home or, you know, your spouse more than you did before, right? Because you took a break and then you came back and now you're noticing things again. So you're dishabituated. And we actually use the word resparkling. Your life has resparkled because you took a break and came back. And we took that word, actually, we stole it from Julia Roberts. We have a quote of Julia Roberts in the book where she says, her typical day is she wakes up, she takes the kids to school, she comes back, she makes lunch, she goes on a bike ride, she, you know, maybe with her husband, then she picks the kids up. And she says, look, if I did the same thing again and again and again every day for years, it would be boring. But I don't. I go away for filming, right? And I come back. And so when I come back, there's pixie dust on it, right? So it never gets boring. And of course, Julia Roberts is not your typical human, right? She's a privileged human being. But I think in this instance, what she's describing is very much true for most of us, that if we just do these same things again and again, then maybe they become boring. But if we kind of leave and then we come back, we can see the good things again. And what studies show is that learning and diversity actually brings people happiness and joy. So people like seeing themselves progressing and learning. And in fact, there's one study that showed that when people had to solve a task and they got money for solving it well, they were happy when they got the money, but they were actually happiest when they learned something new about the task. I think the lesson is just, how could I change my life according to the research that's out there? And some things will work for some people and some things won't, but I think it's worth a try. That on average, when people do go ahead with a change that they're considering, on average, they tend to be happier. The reason that you take little breaks out of things that you enjoy them more, is because it caused you to dishabituate. So one wonderful study that we quote in the book is one where people were asked to think about a song that they like. And they were asked, hey, do you want to listen to the song from beginning to end, no interruptions? Or would you rather hear the song with interruptions? Every 30 seconds or so, we will interrupt you for 5 seconds or 10 seconds. What 99% of people say is like, I want to listen to the song beginning to end, no interruptions, right? It's the obvious kind of answer. It's intuitive. But in fact, when they actually did the study, they found that people enjoy the song more with breaks. Very surprising. The reason is when you start listening to a song that you like, the joy is high, and it starts going down a little bit. You still enjoy it, but the joy goes down. But then if you break it, you dishabituate, and then the joy pops up again, right? And so overall, if you take breaks from things that you enjoy, little breaks, you tend to enjoy them less. They showed this with songs. They showed it with massages. Again, everyone said, I want a massage beginning to end. I don't want an interruption in my massage. But in fact, when they did the test, they found that people enjoy the massage more with little breaks because it caused them to dishabituate.
It's interesting because it's quite counterintuitive. I mean, how many people would want their Spotify playlist interrupted, by breaks every minute? But it's interesting that that's so.
Yeah, and in fact, there's even another study that we didn't know about until we published the book, and then we were told about this that showed that people actually enjoyed watching a TV episode more with commercials, which again, it's counterintuitive because we feel like we never want commercials. We'd pay not to see the commercials, right? So some of these things are surprising, counterintuitive, and they're really kind of hard to grasp, but that's apparently what the experiments show.
Yeah, very surprising. Maybe it's because it's an age of shorter attention spans. I don't know. I thought you had in the book, speaking of adapting, a great method for saving on winter power bills, because we're in autumn now, and soon enough we'll be starting to turn heaters on and electric blankets on. It's interesting about how we adapt to heat and cold.
Yeah, so they did. There's a couple of fun studies there. One is, they put people in actually like cold water. There's one where they put them in the bath for quite a few hours every single day, and they found that yes, they got adjusted to it. They didn't feel as cold. They said it doesn't feel as cold over, the hours and the days, and also when they measured things like how much you shiver, they found that people got used to it, so they shivered less over the days. In another study, they put them in just like a cold room, but it was very similar. I think they had to take off their clothes and be in that cold room for quite a few hours every single day. And yes, the actual physiological response showed that they adjusted. And I think we can. It's something that we can probably see on ourselves if you've moved from one country to another. From a relatively warm climate to a cold climate. At first, it's really, really difficult, but over the years, you adjust to it and you don't feel it as much anymore.
Professor Tali Sharrett is with us. The book is Look Again, The Power of Noticing What Was Always There. So we need to shake up our lives a bit and see things through new pairs of glasses, to be happy. There are more and more, here's another real life example in your book. There are more and more calming measures introduced on our roads to slow us down, where you are as well as where I am. Speed limits around our cities have been brought down and so on. You tell us what happened in Sweden in 1967. I wonder if you'd remind us of that, please.
So in Sweden, in September of 1967, the traffic had to move to the right side from the left side in order to have the reason that they did this, that they wanted to kind of drive on the same side as the other Scandinavian countries around them. And of course, the big concern was that accidents will go up, right? Because it's really difficult to suddenly start driving on the other side of the road. I mean, I've tried this myself. I spend a lot of time in the US and the UK, and it's really, really difficult. But to the surprise of everyone, once they changed the direction of driving, accidents actually went down by 40%. So why is that? Well, when you start driving, the first time you get the license and you start driving, it's a little bit scary, right? It's a scary thing to do. And people are very attentive, right? And they kind of like are very careful and cautious. But obviously, over the months and over the years, you kind of get used to it and you're no longer scared and you're no longer conscious and you maybe don't pay attention as much, despite the fact that accidents is one of the top reasons for fatality. And what happened when they changed the direction of driving is that caused people to dishabituate to the risk of driving, right? Suddenly, the fear came back. And with the fear came more attention and more caution. And so that's why accidents actually went down to such a large degree. But interestingly, after 2 years, people habituated again. And then the number of accidents went just back to baseline.
I wonder if our road tolls would dramatically reduce if we were to do what they did every 2 years and change which side of the road we drive on.
I think that will be a bit extreme to try that, don't you think?
So we go away and we come back into our lives in some fashion to rediscover contentment. I think we understand that. On the other hand, you say with unhappiness, we should swallow it whole, I think is the phrase.
Yeah, so we talked about a little bit about how you want to break the good things into bits, right? So you can dishabituate and enjoy it more, whether it is, you know, don't binge on a Netflix series, just watch, you know, one episode at a time, take little breaks from massages and so on. When it comes to things that are not that great, things that you don't really want to do, like maybe it's household chores or maybe it's some admin work that you need to do. In fact, habituation is your friend, because these negative feelings will go down over time. So in fact, if you finish the whole thing in one go, overall, you will suffer less on average, right? So for example, imagine that you're cleaning the house. Maybe it's a little bit smelly, right? Maybe it's a little bit uncomfortable. You get used to it. You habituate to it. The smell doesn't smell so bad after a while. But if you start taking breaks, right, you're like, well, let me take a coffee break. Well, now when you start again, then the suffering goes up again, right? So in fact, we say, break up the good into bits, but swallow the bad whole.
In this polarized age, Tali, one aspect of your book becomes vital to know. We become habituated to being lied to or shocked, and we stop doing so. And you use the example of what happened gradually in Nazi Germany. In society now, there are people who lie to us and people who do us wrong. I sometimes think about all the hackers and scammers, you know, now ruining people's lives. Out of interest, do they get habituated to that? I mean, maybe at first there's a bit of guilt, but the more they do it, the less they care.
Yeah, and in fact, that was the first study that we did that started this whole book. It's a study that was conducted in my lab. We published it in 2016, where we found that people habituate to their own dishonesty. We brought people into the lab and they played a task where they could lie to gain more money themselves at the expense of the other person. Now, we didn't tell them to lie. We didn't mention the word lie, but they could figure it out. And what was interesting is we found that at the beginning, they lied by just a little bit, just a few cents. And afterwards, they lied by a bit more. Then they started lying by, you know, $1 and $2 and more and more and more. The amount by which they lied snowballed over time. And while they were doing that, we scanned their brains in a brain imaging scanner. And what we found is at the beginning, despite the fact that they lied by just a little bit, there was a strong reaction in the amygdala, which is part of the brain that is important for emotional arousal. And so it seemed like at the beginning, people had a strong emotional, probably negative feeling to lying, which makes sense because most people think that lying is morally wrong, so they feel bad when they do it. But over time, what happened was emotional habituation. Emotional habituation means that you have less of an emotional reaction to things that are repeated. And so as they lied more and more and more, their emotional response actually went down. The amygdala activity was reduced. And the more it was reduced, the more likely they were to lie to a greater extent the next time that they had an opportunity. So it seems that what happened was, because of emotional habituation, there was no negative feeling. So there's nothing to carb their dishonesty, right? So they lied more. Usually, what's carving our dishonesty is a negative feeling. But if you lie more and more and more because of emotional habituation, you don't have that negative feeling. And so you lie to a greater amount. So that's kind of the slippery slope of dishonesty.
So an obvious question, again reflecting the world we live in now, and I know this has been argued and argued about, but if I play Grand Theft Auto or if I watch lots of violent narcos shows, am I going to get habituated to crime around me? Am I, in an extreme example, going to start thinking that dealing drugs isn't so bad? Look at all the nice cars you can buy. What do you think about this area of habituation?
Well, there is some truth to that, not to the extreme that you put it. But first of all, it is true that if you watch violent films, for example, more again and again and again, your reaction would be less and less and less, right? You get used to this violence, and so you will have less of an emotional reaction over time if you do it frequently. Same thing with like violent video games and things like that. Will that then alter your behavior? I think studies show that it can to some extent. It doesn't mean that everyone that's watching like a violent film or playing video games that are violent all the time will end up doing these kind of acts. But it is true that there is at least some effect where you might think that this is more normal. I don't know necessarily if these studies show just correlation or they also show causation, meaning maybe it's just that people who tend to be violent by nature like to watch these kind of films.
Yeah, and then we talk about social media, or we could do for a long time, and whether the kind of attitudes we see on social media inure us to extreme utterances and behaviors in real life. I guess that's a huge area.
I think, one of the things that we say about social media is that a lot of people suspect that perhaps social media has a negative impact on them. Like perhaps it induces some anxiety or stress, but we don't really know to what extent because it's always there. It's a bit like the AC in the background. If you have an AC in the background and you don't really realize it's interfering, with how you're feeling until someone turns it off. And then when they turn it off, you're suddenly like, oh, I feel so much better. It's like, this quiet is so much better. Social media is a bit like that. You don't really realize to what extent it has an effect on you and causes anxiety until you turn it off. And then you could really like see what the impact is, measure it. There was a study conducted by the economist Hans Alcott, where he took two groups of individuals, 1,000 individuals. He gave them $100 each to go off Facebook for a month. This is quite an old study, so he did it on Facebook. And then he had another 1,000 individuals. He gave them $100 not to do anything, continue with life as usual. And then he came back at the end of the month. And what he found was that on every single dimension, those people who went off Facebook for a month were feeling better. They were happier. They were less depressed, less anxious. They had more interactions in person. They were reading books, playing piano, and so on. And they were surprised to what extent going off Facebook had an impact on them. Most people didn't expect such a large effect. So that's an interesting thing. It's like a bit like the AC until you turn it off and then you kind of realize the impact. Also, what was interesting was despite the fact that most people said, oh, I feel so much better, I'm happier, at the end of the month, they all went straight back to Facebook.
What did you find out regarding holidays when you went on a work trip to a resort in the Dominican Republic?
So I did this project. I was consulting a large tourism company, and they wanted to know what makes people happy on holiday and when are they happiest. So we went on the resorts and we surveyed people, and we found that the happiest time was 43 hours into a vacation. 43 hours gave people time to settle in and, unpack and things like that and really focus on fun. But from that time on, joy started dwindling. It went down and down and down. Look, they were still happy on day 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, but not as happy as they were 43 hours in because of habituation, right? And when we ask people, hey, what was the best part of the vacation? The word that they used more than any other word was the word first. The first view of the ocean, the first cocktail I had, the first sandcastle I built. Firsts were exciting and new. Now, the second view of the ocean was quite good, but it wasn't good as the first. The second cocktail, third cocktail, even fifth cocktail was quite good, but it wasn't as good as the first because of this habituation. So that suggests that perhaps it's worth thinking about maybe taking more frequent vacations, but shorter ones, right? Of course, you don't always. It depends on where you're going and how far away it is. But there's a lot of joy to be had from just little getaways.
That makes sense. But I mean, if we knew we were only going to have a 48-hour holiday, we wouldn't get that 43-hour sense of pleasure because anticipation of a long break stretching ahead is part of that joy, even though the joy diminishes, yeah?
Yeah, so that's interesting. And first of all, I would suggest more than 48 hours. You want the whole it goes up to 43 and then you don't want to leave at the peak, right?
That's
Let it
right.
go down a little bit, enjoy and then leave. Maybe think about 4 days, like right? A long weekend kind of thing. But yeah, anticipation is in fact, okay, so I told you that the most happiest day was 43 hours, right, of the vacation. But here's what I didn't tell you, that in fact, the happiest day of all was before they went on vacation. The day before vacation was, in fact, the happiest. It was a day they're still in the office working on the computers, but in their mind, they're already on vacation. And in their mind, it was quite wonderful. When they went on vacation, it was good, but it wasn't as good as it was in their mind the day before. So, indeed, the anticipation often makes us more happy than the event itself.
Better to travel than to arrive.
Well, but
Sort
better
of.
to think about
That's
traveling.
right.
Think about arriving.
Professor Tali Sharrat, look again, the power of noticing what was always there. Just a few more things. Women are less happy even as glass ceilings are broken and equal rights have been achieved to a significant extent anyway. We think it's because they've simply added more load to their lives, still doing the bulk of the cooking, the child rearing, having to compete in the workplace, needing to look good, etc. But what if it's also that if you have fewer choices, you are possibly more reconciled to and therefore more content with what you have? I mean, that's not some veiled argument for patriarchy, but if I am told I can't be a neuroscientist because only women can be neuroscientists, I'll complain about that with my mates at the pub. But I'll forget about it and accept it more. It's an interesting finding about women.
Yeah, so there's these studies, surveys conducted by economists, and they showed that women reported being happier in the 50s and the 60s, when in fact inequality was the highest in the Western world. And then in the 70s, where they started getting equal rights, at least legally, right? In fact, what was observed is a decline in happiness, especially relative to males. Which is interesting. And in fact, there's other studies showing that in unequal societies, females are happier than equal societies. So I think, why is that? Well, one speculation is that in unequal societies, as well as in the 50s and 60s, women didn't have high expectations, right? They didn't expect to be a CEO. They didn't expect to be an astronaut. They didn't expect to be paid the same. As the legal system started changing and they got their legal rights and on paper they should be equal, they started having these expectations. I should be getting those high jobs just like males. I should be getting equal salaries, but the reality wasn't the same. They were told they should be equal, but they weren't equal in practice, and they continued taking care of the kids and so on. This difference between people's expectations and reality can really cause unhappiness. In fact, there's a name for this, a negative prediction error. A negative prediction error is when your expectations are better than the outcomes. And it causes negative mood. But here's the thing, negative mood is not necessarily a bad thing. This unhappiness is good. Because what this unhappiness does, it drives people to try to change reality, right? It's good that they were feeling unhappy. It's good that they had negative mood, because what that did is continue to drive them to create change. And what we're seeing now is, as reality gets a little bit closer to expectations, right? We're not quite there yet. But as the gap starts becoming smaller and smaller, women's happiness is starting to climb up again.
Just before we go, a couple more things. In one of your very well-watched TED Talks, you talk about how graphic warnings on cigarette packets do not stop smokers from smoking. In fact, they may encourage smokers to smoke more. You were warning about warnings, I think, weren't you? Why should this be?
So what we found is that people are more likely to take in unexpected positive information than unexpected negative information. So, for example, if I tell you, if I ask you, you know, how many people are going to listen to this radio show, and you say 500,000, and I say, you know, my data suggests it's going to be 1 million. What we find is that people say, oh, okay, well, maybe, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe it's going to be 1 million. But if I say, you know what, my data suggests it's only going to be 5,000. Our data suggests that people that you would say, nah, she doesn't know what she's talking about, right? So when you give people unexpected negative information, they tend to kind of discard it. They say, I don't believe this. But when you give them unexpected positive information, they say, oh, well, maybe that's true. And they tend to change their beliefs. So on average, this is, you know, one reason why people kind of disregard warning signs, such as the warning signs on cigarette packets. They say, yes, smoking kills, but mostly it kills the other guy. But when they hear that the housing market is going up, they say, ooh, I bet my house will going to rise in price as well. So you kind of want to reframe your message to highlight the opportunity for progress rather than decline. So our data suggests that when the message is things are there's these things that you could do that will get you to a better goal, but the brain tends to kind of like really absorb that quite a bit. The science is there, and it's good that we know about how the mind works and how the brain works. And we hope that this is used for good intentions more than bad intentions. And if people do things for bad intentions and ill, well, hopefully there's policy in place to put to have consequences for that.
Thank you very much for your time, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.